are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wersbianska.
A todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective Best of 2024 Year in Review here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. And we started 2024 by speaking with freelance journalist Michael Fox, the host of Under the Shadow, on the anniversary of the January 8th insurrection in Brazil. And while this insurrection has unavoidable comparisons with the January 6th insurrection in the U.S., the similarities between the two ends when we examine the more measured response in Brazil. Let's take a listen. What is your assessment 1 year after this insurrection? There's probably a balancing act here that's pretty hard to not only define, but also to find a really satisfying conclusion.
Well, always, right? Always. Well, several things I think are important to say, Oscar. First off, on January the 8th, on the anniversary, Lula met with the heads of all the different branches of government, many of the governors of the country in Brasilia, in the National Congress, to remember this date, to look back, and to also carry forward. And it was titled Unshakable Democracy, this event. And it recalls back, reminds us back to kind of what happened in the wake of the January 8th attack, where Lula met with all the different heads of the different branches of power, with all the governors in the country, and they all walked across Brasilia to assess the damages together overnight and to show that the country was united. Remember, looking back exactly 1 year ago, 90% of the population was against the attacks in Brasilia. And so I think that's important to look at what the government on the anniversary has done. But, you know, Oscar, one really important way to assess where we are 1 year later is also to compare this with the January 6th in the United States and the investigations into January 6th. And if you compare that, things in Brazil have moved much, much faster. There's been two parliamentary investigations. One of them found that Bolsonaro was one of the intellectual authors of what happened. And we'll dive into that. We'll get a little bit deeper into that. There's been the Supreme Court investigation. Remember that just in a couple of days after the attack, roughly 1,400 people were jailed and held for a long period of time. We've seen 30 people who have convicted and charged with serving up to 17 years of jail time for destroying the country's democracy and a number of other details. The other 1,300 and some odd people are still, like, they haven't been officially brought to court. They've been released, but they are not innocent. They have not been exempted from legal trials. And so that's going to be happening in the coming months, over the next years. We're going to see what happens. Remember, this also happened. January 8th took place after weeks of Bolsonaro supporters camped out in front of military barracks across the country. And that's important too, because people were also jailed around those military barracks. As soon as January 8th happened, then Lula took charge and really put the pressure on the police and the military to remove people from those barracks across the country and really push back on this movement. And so those people who actually didn't invade the Capitol itself there's been hundreds of people who are now have to do community service and have promised they won't ever do it again. But there's a lot of other people, dozens of people, who are wearing ankle bracelets and are under preventative prison right now because of what's happened. So The pushback from the Brazilian government has been strong. The Supreme Court investigations are still happening. In fact, they've just discovered about a month ago, one of the first financiers, and this is one of the things that Lula said just this week, was he said, listen, the investigations cannot stop until we know who financed it, who was behind it, A, who were the political, the actors, the intellectual authors, but also who financed this. And so they found, they've identified at least two people, one person in the state of Paraná who paid for buses to ship people north to Brasilia. Another person has been arrested in the city of Salvador who also paid for a bus. But what's complicated is that things are very horizontal. Like things are like the as far as the investigation looks and what they've been talking about, a lot of the funds and the financing has happened. It wasn't just one or two people that did it. It was pretty grassroots across the right-wing movement. And that's made it hard for them to identify exactly who was financing all this and who was, putting up the money for the different buses to bring people here and there. But we know that those two people definitely have. And so looking back 1 year later, one of the major critiques that we do have that a lot of you have talked about is that no military officials, no members of the military have been brought to justice or have been brought to trial because of this. And we know that members of the military were involved. They kind of let people walk in. The military and the police, security in Brasilia just kind of let people walk in. And in part, that had to do with the fact that the person who was in charge of security in Brasilia that day was Bolsonaro's former justice minister. And he basically said, okay, it's a free-for-all, do what you want, right? And so he allowed the destruction of the Brazilian capital to happen, roughly $4 to $5 million, which was the amount of damage that occurred in Brasilia that we know. And so it's a devastating, obviously it was a devastating moment. And a lot of people are looking back now. They're taking like kind of this week and these days to look back, understand what happened, but also look back and what does this mean within Brazilian democracy at the time. And I just want, before we move on, I just want to read a quote from Brazil's former Supreme Court Minister, Ricardo Lewandowski, because he said something this week, which I think is really key. He said, you know, fortunately, the institutional mechanisms for defending democracy in Brazil were effective in defeating the coup threats. However, the specter of authoritarianism continues to haunt us as the agents of chaos and discord continue alive, although momentarily withdrawn, waiting for the most favorable moment to launch new coups. So I think this puts it into context. Like the Brazilian institutions worked. They shut down the threat. People are being held responsible. People are going to jail. There have been investigations. The Supreme Court is moving forward. Remember Alexandre Moraes, who's one of the main Supreme Court justices who really pushed back against Bolsonaro during his government. And he's been kind of leading the charge in terms of the Supreme Court investigation into January 8th. But at the same time, this kind of specter of authoritarianism, the specter of possible pro-Bolsonaro, far-right violence still exists in Brazil. And this, I think, is really concerning. You know, in the as we're looking in the States and we're seeing like a new Trump run for the presidency, you know, like,
yeah.
Let's not forget that in the same way that January 6th in the United States or January 8th in Brazil, these were not necessarily coups that the goal was to actually stop the process in the United States or overturn the election in Brazil and Lula's inauguration, have the military come back. They were attempts to destabilize the country. They were attempts to sow chaos. And, you know, if we look at the larger vision of what, say, Steve Bannon, you know, Trump's former White House analyst and the guy who has pushed the whole fake news, election rigging, fake election discourse from Trump to Bolsonaro, his whole thing is about sowing chaos. It's about, and then with that chaos, creating the imaginary or the imagery of what could happen, right? And so it is as much, the attack on January 8th, the attack on January 6th, is as much about creating this moment of hope and excitement among the far right as this symbol, right, as it is about actually creating a coup in the moment, which was never going to succeed in Brazil. And that, I think we need to understand it, because look at Trump, you know, he's making another run for the presidency. Now, Bolsonaro has been, and I think we should talk about this, Oscar, he has been blocked from running for re-election for the next 8 years, but that doesn't mean that his people and his movement can't, right?
And that goes all back to what I mentioned at the beginning, which is sort of this delicate balancing act as to how to assess this all 1 year later, because you're right. The democratic institutions in Brazil held firm, stayed in place, and withstood this insurrection. But at the same time, you know, as you mentioned in your Brazil on Fire podcast, that the right wing in Brazil, especially the fascist elements, are equally as strong. And could this happen again? Who knows? We certainly hope not. But, you know, January 8th, nonetheless, in Brazil, is a cause for concern and a cautionary tale at the very least. Now, you just mentioned Jair Bolsonaro being banned from running for office until 2030. What do you make of this decision? You know, if you could expand a little bit more by the Brazilian court, because as we're having this conversation this month, there seems to be a movement here in the U.S. of barring Donald Trump from certain states for January 6th here in the U.S. So what do you make of this? Because it may come across as a slippery slope in the U.S., but in Brazil, how do you make of this? Because, again, the decision's already been made in Brazil that he's barred altogether from running for office until 2030. So can you further expand on that?
Yeah. And actually, Oscar, this is such an important point. I did a story about this when it happened in late June and ended up doing a story for The Real News about this and making the connection to the United States, comparing Brazil with the United States about the situation. So I'm so glad we're going to dive into this.
It's unavoidable. We're going to make the comparisons.
It's unavoidable. But it's really important to understand what free speech means in Brazil and the United States and how far supposed free speech is allowed to go. So the Supreme Court banned Bolsonaro from running back in late June for the next 8 years because of a meeting that he held with foreign ambassadors in which he spread fake news about the electoral system, basically said it was rigged, spread information. And they looked back at that date. This was in the lead up to obviously the 2022 elections. And what the Supreme Court did was they looked back at that moment when he was spreading this fake news throughout this meeting and then on social media channels. And in fact, Alexandre Moraes, the Supreme Court justice who I mentioned earlier, his quote at the time was, he spread lies, fraudulent information. They were not opinion. It was actual lies, right? And this is really important because basically what the Supreme Court ruled at that time, and there could be even be more consequences. Remember, I mean, Bolsonaro is just like Trump. He made many, many statements, and this was just the very first. It was just the tip of the iceberg, many analysts believe. But basically what they said was Bolsonaro, his free speech rights in the United States did not trump the country's democracy. The country's democratic norms and the country's electoral system was more important than Bolsonaro's right to spread lies and disinformation. And that is why they made this ruling. He was the first president in Brazilian history or former president to ever be ruled against for electoral violations. And that's what this was. And basically, he said that the elections were rigged. And that's why the Supreme Court said, you cannot run for the next 8 years. Now, I've been speaking with legal scholars that kind of cross the borders between Brazil and the United States. And the main thing that they've talked about is how much in the United States, how sacrosanct, how important are free speech rights. And we've often in the past, we thought about free speech rights as a really positive thing, right? I mean, obviously that's how we've won civil liberties. That's how we've been able to fight for our rights. But when we start to get into the world of fake news, this gets really complicated because the United States still defends people's right to share and spread fake news, even in a case when that is an actual affront or attack against U.S. democracy. And what many legal scholars at the time, a few months ago that I was speaking with, told me was that, okay, so Bolsonaro's banned, but the possibility that Trump might be banned for what he has said against the U.S. electoral system is much less. Now, I love the fact that you brought up what's been happening lately in Maine and in some other states where they're actually
Colorado.
yeah, in Colorado, where they're actually banning Trump from being on the ballots in those states. And I think that's kind of like the only option, you know, we have. Of course, it's a different situation. The United States, its electoral system is all broken up state by state. So it's almost the states themselves that have to do this. You don't have an overall electoral council like you have in Brazil and so many other countries in the Western Hemisphere that rule over the elections with an electoral court. And so it is really state by state that has to do this. But we still have this complicated notion of the right of free speech rights in the United States, even when they pertain to disinformation, fake news, and lies. And this is really important, Oscar, and we need to understand. I actually been thinking about doing a longer series of stories about this to get to be able to wrap our heads about this in the United States, because I don't think, you know, people will talk about free speech and his right to do this, and even like Glenn Greenwald, his whole thing now, where this investigated journalist who talked a lot, but his whole thing is about his right to say anything he wants to, and he will defend Trump, and he will defend Bolsonaro, and he will appear on Fox News all he wants to, because all his whole thing is about the freedom to say whatever he wants. But it doesn't matter if that's attacking the country's democracy. It doesn't matter if that's fake news, right? And we need to really wrap our heads around this and understand the United States within the context of Brazil and other countries, because in Europe, the EU and the European Union is starting to push back also on this question of do I really have the right to spread information and fake news, and how much can that be regulated, or should it be regulated by social media? And so these are new things we're trying to grapple with, I think, in this world, particularly this new world of social media and fake news and all this over the last couple decades. Brazil is on the forefront of really pushing back. Alexandre de Moraes has shown that in this last elections, where if fake news came out, he changed the law. Originally, it was like social media platforms had something like 24 hours to take down whatever the fake news that they ruled fake news. And then during the election, there was so much of it, he actually decreased the amount of time they had to like 2 hours. So it meant that social media platforms had to take it down, or they could go off air, or they could be fined by the Supreme Electoral Court in Brazil. And so they're taking drastic action that I do not see the United States having the means to take, which is why fake news will be continue to be so prominent. It always is. This is the new world we're living in. But in the United States, this is going to be a problem over the next year.
2024 also saw an increase in Trump-like authoritarians gaining further ground in various parts of Latin America. Chief among them is Nayib Bukele of El Salvador, who has led a state of exception that has led to thousands of Salvadorans to be arrested and imprisoned without due process. And in an effort to maintain control and whitewash his authoritarianism, the Bukele administration hired Florida Representative Matt Gaetz and other Republican lawmakers to create the quote-unquote El Salvador Caucus. Alexis Tumbelis, the executive director of CISPIS, told us more about the consequences of this criminal whitewashing. Alexis, along with CISPIS, has a new article that came out this month in NACLA entitled "New El Salvador Caucus Appears Set to Do Bukele's Bidding in Congress," as human rights violations under El Salvador's more than two-year-long state of exception continue to mount. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers seek to whitewash the abuses. And so with that said, let's begin by explaining what is the El Salvador Caucus. And to do so, let's hear from Florida Representative Matt Gaetz himself as he introduced this new caucus to the House. Let's take a listen.
El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, has converted El Salvador from the murder capital of the world into a reliable and stable partner for peace and security for the United States of America. The El Salvador Caucus will exist to nurture and advance the U.S.-El Salvador relationship, to encourage strong borders, strong culture, and the strong reforms that President Bukele has put into effect. They've defeated the gangs. They've put prosperity on the march in El Salvador, and even the 70,000 people who are incarcerated in that country are not just seeing their lives wasted away. President Bukele has instituted a zero leisure policy where they are now restoring buildings and murals and actually rebuilding the country that so many of them had a hand in ravaging through gang warfare. The purpose of this caucus will be to vindicate the choices that President Bukele has made that indeed strengthen the U.S.-El Salvador relationship. And El Salvador's resurgence has not existed as a consequence of falling for the siren song of globalism. Instead, President Bukele believes that the way El Salvador can lead within Central America and indeed throughout the West is by being the best version of themselves, not being excessively reliant on some of these globalist institutions.
So that was Florida Representative Matt Gaetz describing in his own words this new caucus, the El Salvador caucus that he's created. Now, Alexis, I want to get your response about this, but obviously people can't see us, but you were obviously shaking your head as you heard Gaetz's description of this new El Salvador caucus. And along the way, we'll describe some of the crimes against humanity that's taken place during the state of exception. We've covered it several times with other guests with regards to El Salvador during the course of the year since the state of exception has begun almost 2 years ago. But right off the bat, you heard his description of the El Salvador caucus. But I want to see if you give us your response after listening to that. And also, if you could tell us who comprises this new caucus, because I think it's very important to note that this has nothing to do with Republican versus Democrat bias here, as you explain.
It's really remarkable to listen to an elected member of Congress take to the House floor and repeat so clearly the talking points, the PR campaign that the Bukele administration has spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 5, 6, 7 years to repeat. I mean, it's shocking to hear the words that Bukele uses so often to talk about his vision just parroted on the House floor. And it's something that I think people in the U.S. need to be really aware of and concerned about, that there's a group in Congress that is now actively seeking to, exactly what he said, vindicate Bukele's choices. What are those choices? We're talking about an illegal suspension of constitutional rights for over 2 years. We're talking about over 80,000 people who've been arrested without warrants. And there are estimates by human rights organizations in El Salvador that up to a third of those people may have had absolutely nothing to do with criminal activity, with gangs, with anything. Hundreds of them have died in prison under the state's conditions. So those are the choices that Bukele is making. And so that there's an active effort in the United States going on within the United States government to whitewash, to normalize, to legitimize what the entire international human rights community, and we're talking organizations, bodies like the United Nations, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, have very clearly spelled out as a catastrophe for human rights, for constitutional law, for the state of democracy. And I think it's very telling that there's a group of people in Congress, not only who are willing to sign on to that vision, and certainly when you're hearing from people like Matt Gaetz, who are very close with the Trump campaign, you know, it's not a surprise that some of the people, you know, we are hearing a lot of those same authoritarian tendencies, obviously, from a lot of people in the Trump camp. So it's not a surprise in that regard that there would be people on the far right here in the United States who would look at what Bukele is doing and embrace it as a model, not only for the hemisphere, but maybe what they would like to see for a second Trump presidency here in the United States. So that doesn't come necessarily as a surprise from an ideological level, including because Bukele has really been actively cultivating these ties with the far right in the U.S. for the last several years and globally more recently. But I think it's a very big concern that it's a bipartisan group. There are two Democrats in the caucus, Vicente Gonzalez and Lou Correa. The other 12 members are Republicans, and some of them are among the most right-wing voices, among the most anti-immigrant voices that exist within the Republican Party. But I think seeing their efforts as well to not just be a platform, give speeches, but to actually attempt to shift the U.S.'s policies towards El Salvador is something that people in the U.S. should be very concerned about, that those efforts to normalize a catastrophe in El Salvador are happening within the U.S. government.
So like I said before, we've done numerous shows on El Salvador with regards to the state of exception, and even on Bukele's presidency since it began numerous times here on the show. So I would encourage everyone to go to latinomediacollector.com to listen to those previous stories, those previous episodes with numerous guests with regards to Bukele and his administration. But for the casual observer of Salvadoran politics, for those who may not be familiar with Salvadoran politics, can you tell us about a political report that mentioned a few MAGA luminaries that attended Nayib Bukele's illegal inauguration to a second term? I think this is important for people who don't follow Salvadoran politics or Salvadoran society in the same way as you and I have, to understand that sometimes the company you keep can say a lot about what the state of affairs are in the country, correct?
Absolutely. And I think people need to pay very close attention to people's actions, even more so than their words. And I think there's a lot of Bukele's policies now that show that he's very clearly and very squarely in the right wing camp, not just politically from an authoritarian point of view, but economically in terms of abandoning any efforts that had been made previously to build a social safety net, to have tax equality, to sort of reduce inequality in the country. There's been huge reversals, including on an economic front, in terms of poverty rates in El Salvador are going up, food insecurity rates are going up, and there's a lot of, people's actions speak louder than their words. And I think something that's important to know about Bukele is that he's a he has dedicated a lot of resources and he has a lot of experience in PR. And so a lot of what he does is to sell an image of himself, whatever he thinks the image at the time needs to be. So when Bukele ran for president, he had done so as an independent, and he had previously been a mayor for the left-wing political party, the FMLN, in El Salvador. And so he had a lot of people convinced that he was the new left. He was to the left of the left. He was going to be the new generation of the left and bring the left forward into the 21st century and give the young generation a chance. And that was clearly all a wolf in sheep's clothing. Fast forward 6 years, he is defying the Constitution, breaking the Constitution to run again, which is illegal, unconstitutional in El Salvador. And what is the first international event that he attends after he is inaugurated for this second unconstitutional term? CPAC, here in the DC area. He was one of two international guests, along with Javier Milei from Argentina. And they are the new right-wing superstars that a very clear ideological camp here in the United States is looking to celebrate, uphold, to build alliances with. And Bukele apparently is all about that now. And I think what we have seen, there was an article in Politico that came out about the quote-unquote MAGA field trip to Bukele's inauguration. And that was, it's hard to tell where some of these congressional people fit into this, because there's certainly people like Matt Gaetz who are in the MAGA camp and other people who went to the inauguration who sort of share that ideological perspective include Don Trump Jr. was there, Tucker Carlson was there, high-level people from CPAC were there, it sounds like. And so you're sort of seeing this very intentional pairing of a particular slice of the far right in U.S. politics. And that's something that there's been some really important investigative reporting by journalists from El Faro, which is an online news outlet that was previously based in El Salvador, about the lobbying that the Salvadoran government has been paying for to cultivate these particular relationships with the U.S. right and some influential voices on the U.S. right. So this is really interesting because these are not people who support Salvadoran immigrants here in the United States. And as many people know, you know, they're almost a third of the Salvadoran population lives outside of the country. And the majority of those people live in the United States. And that's been a phenomenon that's been happening for decades. But it's very telling, significant, distressing for me thinking about it, that the alignment that the president of a country would have is with a group of people politically in a country that are openly opposing welcoming migrants from that country, that are pushing for mass deportation policies. What does that mean, that this is who the president of El Salvador is aligning himself with in the United States?
You're listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024, looking back on some of the most important stories covered on the show, and you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Latino Media Collective Year in Review 2024, looking back on some of the most important stories covered on the show. And on this segment, we speak with Karma Chavez, an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities, about the challenges that the LGBTQ community has faced even before Trump returns to power. Obviously, what brings us to this conversation today is the dark shadow of a new Trump administration coming along. But before we even begin discussing the new Trump administration, let's start by discussing the wave of anti-LGBTQ legislation last year and how it sort of serves as perhaps a harbinger of what we saw this year. You know, before we even started recording the show today, I told you that last year there were so many copycat anti-LGBTQ laws going out throughout the country that it felt like it was hard to keep up with each and every one and what it meant for each and every state, each and every community. So I felt like we need to begin here in order to understand that what's taking place this year did not begin this year. And it didn't even begin in 2023 either.
Yeah, no, it didn't begin 2023. It didn't begin with Donald Trump. I mean, you know, the truth of the matter is we've seen attacks on the LGBT community for a long time. It's hard to keep that in mind when we think about some of the issues that people consider to be wins, like the legalization of same-sex marriage, et cetera. But yeah, 2023 was a rough one. I think the ACLU says there were 510 anti-LGBTQ bills that were proposed in almost every single state across the country. I think all the states, but maybe three, proposed at least one anti-LGBTQ bill. And these bills ranged from things like, probably among the most common were school sports bans. And these are about banning transgender athletes from being able to play sports on the team of the gender that they identify with. A lot of these were also about locker rooms and who can use what locker rooms and what bathrooms in schools. Some of them were related to actual curriculum censorship. And so these we might think of as the banned books laws, which largely got rid of, I would say, trans content and any genderqueer content. We can't, of course, forget about the drag queen laws, the anti-drag queen laws that make it, you know, so the drag queens can't do readings at libraries or, you know, have any kind of connection at all. There were more healthcare restrictions, specifically making it harder for trans folks to be able to get access to healthcare in order to not be in a state of gender dysphoria. And there are a wide range of others. I mean, they were just kind of all over the place. You know, where I live in Texas, I think our legislators proposed 55 anti-LGBTQ laws. Not all of those got passed, but some of them did. So yeah, it was a rough year last year.
Yeah, certainly. And I do want to expand on the issue of free speech on college campuses as well, particularly in Texas, because Governor Greg Abbott over there was pretty much front and center
with this anti-DEI hysteria that we saw last year, in addition to all this anti-LGBTQ legislation that we saw. And I think it will be very clear that the people that are pushing the anti-DEI stuff are the same people that are pushing the anti-LGBTQ stuff throughout the country. It's almost one and the same. And it's interesting that you mentioned the ACLU. You mentioned that at least 500 such bills passed last year alone. I think it's 232, maybe the exact number this year. It's still a high number. But as you said, 2023 was a particularly rough year. And it expands not just to education and freedom of speech, but also public health as well. As we record this conversation today, reports have suggested that Trump may appoint the anti-vaccine conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Among many problematic views on public health, RFK Jr. has been reported to be in favor of restricting access to gender-affirming care for transgender minors. He has also peddled conspiracy theories as it pertains to HIV and AIDS within the LGBTQ community. All disturbing. I'm curious to know, where do we begin to process the dangers of this line of thinking in the highest medical posts in the country? And I'm not just saying that as a host of a show. I'm telling you this as somebody who's also worked for many years in the public health sector, and I'm just as alarmed as to what's going to happen here, because even during the pandemic, I'm not sure if the medical institutions of this country at the highest level are prepared for somebody to just destroy things. The very nature of medical science, it's just alarming and disturbing to see what's going to happen on the horizon here.
This is a challenging one. I mean, I would say, I'm not a historian. My last book, The Border of AIDS, though, was a historical book and what was looking at questions around public health and activism, immigration, and HIV. And, you know, one of the things that we have to keep in mind about public health at the federal level is that the way that it's been enacted has often had a sort of antagonistic relationship with communities that are marginalized. So whether that's around sexuality or whether that's around race. So, of course, we can think about the Tuskegee experiment in Alabama in the early 20th century as perhaps the most egregious example of this. But we can also think about the things that happened during the 1980s with regard to HIV and AIDS. And in that case, because of rampant homophobia, you know, the public health service took some positions that made it very hard for people to get access to the care that they needed. They didn't get the funds appropriated that they needed. And in fact, the public health service endorsed a ban on HIV positive immigrants, despite that there was not a public health rationale for that. So I just offer those couple of examples to say that people from marginalized backgrounds in this country have always kind of had an antagonistic relationship with public health, even when there are actual experts in some of these roles. Now, when you get to the situation that we might be looking at now with someone who doesn't have a medical degree, someone who doesn't have a background outside of, as far as I can tell, you know, conspiracy theories and sort of fringe views that don't hold up to scientific merit, I think we're putting everybody at risk. But as we know, if everybody's at risk, that's not going to be doled out in the same way for everyone. And so folks that come from marginalized backgrounds are going to get it the worst. And we've seen already that trans folks are the absolute target when it comes to healthcare right now. There's a lot of hysteria around what it means for trans people to have the affirming healthcare they need, whether they're teenagers or adults. And I think that's probably, for me, one of the biggest particular concerns, although I think the concerns are extend far beyond that as well.
Yeah, in the coming weeks ahead, one of the things that we plan to do on the show is to dedicate an hour exclusively with regards to Haitians, the Haitian community here in this country, and how they were demonized during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, not only in the 80s, but in the early 90s as well. And so it's also quite timely considering how the Haitian community as well became a punching bag during this electoral cycle. And if you're Haitian and also part of the LGBTQ community, it's an even more disturbing time period, to say the least, in these times as well. So during the course of this presidential campaign, I feel so embarrassed in bringing this up, we saw perhaps the most vile and bigoted campaign commercials against the LGBTQ community on network television, cable TV news, and on social media. I'm curious to know what your thoughts on the normalization of such bigotry on mainstream media during the course of this 2024 electoral cycle alone, because I have to say that it's one thing for mainstream media to take advertising dollars to run these ads, because I've done countless shows here with regards to the ills of capitalism, especially as it pertains to journalism. But it bothers me how people who are otherwise decent and supportive on so many other things can normalize this thing and not at the very least raise alarm bells that this is not okay. It's one thing to see the opportunism of taking ad revenue for these ads, but what bothers me equally as much is the indifference of otherwise good people in normalizing what we saw during the course of this electoral cycle.
Well, has this not been the year of normalizing that which is absolutely egregious? And maybe I shouldn't even mention the fact of what's happening in Gaza right now. We have normalized so much. And when it comes to the LGBT community and the ways that it's once again become okay to target us, to make us seem in all sorts of ways that, you know, some may be true, right? I mean, we have to accept the fact that there are folks in the LGBT community, like there are folks in the straight community, who like all sorts of stuff, right? So, and I don't think that should be demonized. And those we may think are, we know those representations are meant to be demonizing in a certain way, but I think there also has to be space to say, hey, whatever you want to do in your bedroom, you want to do in your bedroom, however you want to dress, however you want to dress. Having that said, I think what's most terrifying for me really has to do both with youth and those who are really struggling with their mental health. When that kind of discourse gets normalized, I mean, we've seen this throughout history. The truth is, it's just been the last few years where it hasn't been okay to be absolutely homophobic in public. So we're kind of back to maybe where we were 15, 20 years ago. And it's really scary for, like I said, those two groups in particular. But in general, I think to be a queer person in this environment, it's like, you know that people don't necessarily think you're human. And you know that some people might think you're human, but they're okay with the fact that other people don't think it. And they're okay with them having their quote unquote free speech to express those views. Meanwhile, we're trying to ban DEI on college campuses.
And for this episode, we turn our attention to Colombia and how a landmark case against Chiquita Brands sheds further light on how the free movement of capital undermines democracy with deadly results. Freelance writer Joshua Collins gave us more details about this landmark case that happened during the summer. Let's begin by quoting the press release by Earth Rights International, which is the NGO that represented the plaintiffs in this case, with the following, quote, "The jury's decision reaffirms what we have long asserted. Chiquita knowingly financed the AUC, a designated terrorist organization, in pursuit of profit, despite the AUC's egregious human rights abuses, by providing over $1.7 million in illegal funding to the AUC from 1997 to 2004, Chiquita contributed to untold suffering and loss in the Colombian regions of Urabá and Magdalena, including the brutal murders of innocent civilians," end quote. So beginning there, can you give us more details from the ruling and tell us about the significance of the case in fighting human rights abuses in Colombia?
So it's the first time that a U.S. company has been found liable. Guilty is not the right word. It's a civil trial, but has been found liable for financing and conspiring with human rights abuses outside of the U.S. We've seen a number of lawsuits in Latin America, or at least investigations into other companies that have done similar things. But this is the first time that a large company has been found liable under U.S. law. So it's a pretty big precedent. As for how it affects Colombia, well, there's an ongoing case here, a criminal case against Chiquita, against eight of the executives from the period when they were paying the AUC. It's been very slow moving, but a lot of people are hoping that this gives momentum to the case. The president here, Gustavo Petro, made a statement the other day that was calling on Colombia's Peace Corps to investigate these findings and move the case along. Colombia also has a new prosecutor. Luz Adriana Camargo Garzón, who has also expressed interest in reopening, well, it was never closed, but in applying resources and attention to this case. So I think it's pretty safe to say that this is an impetus for the Colombian justice system to pressure investigators to put more resources and time into this case that's well over a decade long. So the background is that in 2007, Chiquita pleaded guilty to a State Department case in the United States of paying the AUC almost $2 million and 100 separate payments and disguising those payments as security, like legitimate security costs for the company. That is, they were fixing their books. They pled guilty to that as part of a plea bargain. They got $7 million fine. That's a sizable fine, but hardly something that would put Chiquita out of business. At the time, it was kind of viewed as a slap on the wrist. 8 employees from the company were fired. But this seems to be a much more impactful decision, both in the question of the amount of money changing hands, as well as precedents. And then there's also a number of other, both formal and informal investigations happening in Colombia towards other large North American companies. Coca-Cola has been implicated in trial by paramilitaries here in front of Colombia's Peace Court. To briefly explain, Colombia signed a peace deal in 2016 with rebel group the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, better known as the FARC in English. That put an end to a 53-year civil war, technically, although there are still after effects of the war happening to this day. As part of that deal, they created an independent judicial branch called the Peace Court, the Jurisdicción Especial de la Paz. And that body has been investigating the civil rights abuses of both illegal armed groups and the government during the civil war. There are ongoing testimonies about paramilitary financing that have implicated Coca-Cola, a company that used to be called Gran Colombia Gold from Canada. They're now called Aris Mining. And it's also implicated Drummond Mining, the Alabama-based coal company. Of those companies, only Drummond has an active criminal case in Colombia. But I think that the general opinion here is that this puts a lot of public pressure on investigators who were appointed by very right-wing administrations in the past, intended to be very business-friendly. This is putting pressure on a left-wing administration to follow up with some of these investigations that might have been quashed or at least slowed down by previous prosecutors. So I believe that it's safe to say this is very impactful, at least on a symbolic level, for Colombian justice.
Yeah, and your article makes it very clear that this ruling is not the end of prosecution towards Chiquita, but probably the beginning with regards to other similar cases and accusations towards Chiquita, which again, formerly known as United Fruit Company, but we'll get to that portion of their history later. So I think you may have answered this already, but according to your next article, could you explain how the 2016 peace agreement with the FARC played a role in the investigations led to this court ruling, and how does this Chiquita case tie perhaps to Colombia's false positive scandal from a few years ago? It may not seem like there's a direct tie at first, but I think we could explain that later on as we continue here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that you and a lot of you and your listeners are aware that the country, Colombia, is still reeling from the after effects of a more than half century civil war. The period for which Chiquita was found liable for paying paramilitary groups, AUC, was during the most violent part of Colombia's civil war, late 90s, early 2000s. So to answer your second question about how that ties into the false positives case, I have to kind of explain how the paramilitaries were created here in Colombia. So in the late 90s, a law passed that created these groups called convivirs, and that allowed private citizens and businesses to form defense groups because there were a lot of attacks by rebel forces on private infrastructure and private companies. Now, in theory, that law was supposed to prohibit money from going to illegal groups like the AUC, the AUC, whatever you want to call it. But in practice, there was very little regulation. And those combovirs, as part of Colombian investigations, it turns out that they were massively funding these paramilitary groups. And it's part of the reason why the AUC, among hundreds of others, became so incredibly powerful during that period. During the Civil War, those groups were providing intelligence, logistics, support to Colombian military forces as part of fighting rebel groups. They were created to oppose the rebel groups, but they're nominally allied with the government as well. The problem, though, is that a lot of them quickly began to engage in extremely illegal behavior that included massacres, threats that removed people from their land so that large corporations could buy it. Agriculture was a big part of that. So was mining. There was a lot of industries that were tied into this. And so the false positives case was reinvestigated by the JEP, I believe, 3 years ago. I'll have to check the date. But the numbers were updated. What the case involved was that every year, every month, the military released statistics, fatalities of rebel groups they had killed. The idea was to portray this sense of like we're winning the war against the communists. But the false positive scandal was, it turns out that 6,400 people were killed by military forces that were completely innocent, and the military knew they were innocent. And they were killed by the forces to inflate those casualty reports, to give a sense that the Colombian military forces were winning the war against the rebels. It's a horrific case. The details are horrific. But we have multiple cases, and these are not just accusations. These are testimonies as part of Colombia's peace court, as well as Colombia's criminal courts, that paramilitaries were providing intelligence on who would be put into these false positive cases, as well as logistical supports, and sometimes even carrying out the murders themselves and delivering the bodies to the armed forces. They're probably not responsible for the vast majority of those deaths, but they did give very real material aid to that effort. And those killings were happening while Chiquita was paying the AUC. Here, the false positives case is emblematic of how bad the Civil War got and how both sides used terror and murder as a weapon to control civilian populations.
And to support your point, right about this time last year, the Washington Post reported that General Mario Montoya, the U.S.-trained general who headed Colombia's army, was charged with war crimes almost a year ago. And I bring this up with regards to the false positives case because one of the places that he led the military was in Antioquia, which is not that far, correct me if I'm wrong, from one of the two regions in the Chiquita case that was mentioned earlier at the top of the program.
So Urabá is actually a sub-region of Antioquia. So that's like the northern tip of Antioquia. And yeah, he was convicted. And what's interesting, another tie into the Chiquita case, is that he was convicted largely on testimony from a former AUC leader called Salvatore Mancuso. And Mancuso also testified in this Chiquita trial in the U.S. So we have ex-paramilitary leaders that are now trying to cooperate with Colombia's peace court in return for leniency for some of the crimes they committed. But that is very interesting. So Mancuso testified that not only was there not extortion, like there was no pressure from the AUC on Chiquita to make these payments. As I said, they weren't threats. They weren't like, give us money or we'll blow up your infrastructure. It was more that the AUC was approached by Chiquita because they were having problems with rebel groups in the region, and hired in what prosecutors described as an equal partnership. Chiquita's defense was that they were extorted and pressured and feared for their lives, and that's why they made these payments. But this testimony was rebutted in the Miami court case by Chiquita employees, residents in the region, and even two ex-paramilitary leaders who were working in the region at that time.
I was just about to ask you about that, if you could elaborate a little bit more on this, because as we often do on the show, we're going to create a link to your NACLA article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about this fascinating story, because included with the details that you just mentioned is actual evidence, like images of the evidence that was used in this court case. So with that said, going into some details of the case itself, can you explain Chiquita Brands' quote-unquote justification for funding the AUC and how former Chiquita employees as well as former members of the AUC discredited their claims during the course of this court proceeding?
Right. So that was an interesting defense strategy on the part of Chiquita. They denied they should be held liable for violence perpetuated by the AUC. They're arguing they were extorted by the AUC and those payments were made under duress because they feared for their own lives and their own employees, which sets up an interesting defense because the executives from Chiquita were arguing in court that they knew how brutal the AUC was. They knew that it was a terrorist organization. They knew that massacres were being carried out. There was no attempt to say, like, look, we had no idea. This was a matter of, like, ignorance. We were just trying to pay for security. No, quite the contrary. And that was part of their strategy to try and show to the court that they were scared, that these actions were taken under duress. But the defense argued that no one was making Chiquita stay in Colombia at the height of the Civil War. Nobody was making Chiquita acquire contracts for more banana production and more land at the height of the Civil War. But not just that, there were a number of internal communications that were very damning. One was an internal email from 2003, where an internal director wrote to the legal department from the office in the U.S. to the Colombian department, like, guys, we seem to be committing a felony here. And yet Chiquita continued payments for almost another entire year. Not just that, there were internal documents that showed that they were using subcontractors and disguising these payments as security payments, in quotes, in tax filings to the U.S., which is fraud. That's a serious felony. There were also internal memos about meetings with Carlos Castaño Gil, who is like widely known as the godfather of paramilitarism in Colombia. To illustrate a bit who Carlos Castaño is to your listeners, he launched the earliest versions of the paramilitaries in Colombia. They were a direct response to the Medellin cartel in the 90s. They were basically created to kill rebels and to kill them.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. After months of delay, President-elect Donald J. Trump today became the first American president to be criminally sentenced. Trump was convicted on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, and today he was sentenced to an unconditional discharge, meaning that Trump's conviction will appear on his permanent record, but he will not face imprisonment, a fine, or probation. Justice Juan Merchan delivered the decision a day after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an attempt by Trump's legal team to delay sentencing before the Republican leader's inauguration on January 20th. Trump appeared at the hearing virtually from his Mar-a-Lago home in Palm Beach. Before the sentence was announced, Trump addressed the court. He maintained his innocence in the case he described as a political witch hunt. Trump's legal team, led by attorney Todd Blanche, plans to appeal the verdict. In more news, at least 10 people have died this week in wildfires across Los Angeles County, but officials warn the death toll may rise once it's safe for investigators to access neighborhoods. Fast-moving fires have scorched over 25,000 acres and destroyed nearly 2,000 homes, businesses, and other structures. The Palisades fire, which is now the most destructive ever to hit Los Angeles County, and the Eaton fire, which has devastated communities, remain mostly uncontained. 153,000 residents are now under evacuation orders, and another 166,000 are under evacuation warnings. Crews made progress against the fires yesterday as the Santa Ana winds weakened, but gusts picked up across the region as the day went on. Firefighter teams expect more wind and dry conditions to complicate efforts this weekend and into next week. In other news, research published in The Lancet Medical Journal today estimates that the number of Palestinians killed during the first 9 months of the Israeli war on Gaza was around 40% higher than recorded by the territory's health ministry. The analysis concludes that 64,260 Palestinians in Gaza were killed by traumatic injury up to June 30, 2024. The Palestinian Health Ministry reported that number was 37,877. The peer-reviewed statistical analysis was conducted by academics at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, Yale University, and other institutions. The toll was only for deaths from traumatic injuries, so it did not include deaths from a lack of health care or food, or the thousands of missing believed to be buried under rubble. The Supreme Court today seemed likely to uphold a law that would ban TikTok in the United States beginning January 19th, unless the popular social media program is sold by its China-based parent company. The law passed last year with broad bipartisan support and was signed by President Biden. TikTok and a group of its users challenged the law, saying it violates their First Amendment rights. Congress said the law was necessary because ByteDance is controlled by the Chinese government and that its ability to harvest vast amounts of personal information from American users is therefore a national security threat.